Listen, while I tell you of the wrath of Achilles, his argument with Agamemnon, which brought so many heroes down to Hades' house.
You are listening to a podcast from the room behind the bookcase.
So I am here with Tom Goodale.
Hello.
And Christine Cooper.
Hello.
And we have just finished. Well, we haven't just finished the Iliad, because we've just finished the Iliad. Then we've had a bit of a pause to sit around and go, oh my goodness. And then we've eaten an awful lot of food, including some bread and butter pudding. But apart from that, we have just finished the Iliad as part of the 2014 Epic Weekend, the second Epic Weekend. So, Tom, can you talk a little bit about last year's Epic Weekend and what happened?
Well, last year, the previous year, got an email from Christine saying she's organising a weekend for 24 people to tell books from the Odyssey. I thought, this is an absolutely fantastic idea. You know, I love the Odyssey, and it's something I've been meaning to work on. I'd done a week with Hugh and Daniel at Kai Mabon. I thought, this is a great opportunity. We were each allocated one of the books of the Odyssey to do half an hour of. To spend half an hour on, and we met up at the weekend. I know some of the people met up beforehand in people's houses to practice their sections, but we met up at the weekend. It was it was just an amazing weekend of good food, good fellowship, and fantastic telling. Some people telling for the first time. You know, there was one person never told before, but we had there was a space at weekend. And he did an absolutely fantastic job. And it was incredible. It's a way to approach this material which you just don't normally get the opportunity to do. You've got 24 voices there, and yeah, it was absolutely fantastic.
It really did feel, last year we had about 40, was it about 40 people?
It was 40 people,
about 40 people turning up. We had quite a lot of listeners and musicians. So around the main body of telling the epic and the kind of 24 storytellers with their chapter each, we had this great sense of it being supported and people bringing musicians in. Amanda brought in all those musicians at the end to kind of participate in that.
When Dawn had risen from the bed, which she shares with Tithonus, her mortal husband, Zeus sent down Strife to the Achaeans, a goddess of pain. She stood on the deck of the ship of glorious Odysseus, in the middle of the line, so that with a shout she could be heard from the ships of Telamonian Ajax at one end, and of Achilles at the other, for these two, trusting to their strength and bravery, had drawn up their ships on the extreme flank. And she held aloft a banner of war and gave her great and terrible cry. And immediately the hearts of the Achaeans were filled with the courage and spirit of war, so that going into battle became sweeter to them than returning in their hollow ships to their native lands.
And the Epic Weekend was the brainchild of Christine Cooper. Well, so do you want to talk to us a little bit about where you got the idea from and why you decided you wanted to do it? She's pulling this face when I said it was her brainchild.
It's not my brainchild at all. It's been done by quite a lot of people, actually. But the reason I wanted to do it is because I was travelling in Canada. I was doing some shows over there. And I was hosted by two amazing women, Jennifer Cayley and Jan Andrews. They run a production company called Two Women Productions, based in Canada, near Ottawa. And they had agreed to host me doing a show for a couple of nights. And so I got to spend quite a few days with them in their amazing log cabin by a lake in a wild forest. It's about 2 hours from Ottawa, so it's close enough to be handy, but it's wild and, you know, feels like you're in the middle of nowhere. And they were very hospitable and very, very interesting people with lots to say about storytelling. And they've done a lot of work to promote storytelling in Canada. Somehow this subject of the epics came up. They did a production of The Odyssey last year for an arts centre, so I think that's probably how we got onto it. But they told me how, quite a while ago, back in the 90s, I think, they did these epic weekends every year on their property. So people would come and camp. It was even more informal than here because there was no hiring of a place involved. And everybody would just bring a dish of food. It was not planned at all. It always worked out perfectly. They would eat. They'd do it in summer, so they'd eat on the picnic tables. They've got a kind of veranda outside their house. They hired a marquee in case of rain, or they just told outside if it didn't rain. And they just told me about this wonderful experience. They got these tellers to come along and tell with them, and then lots of the tellers brought partners or friends or whoever who didn't necessarily sit and listen to the whole story. You know, they might want to go for a walk for a couple of hours, and that was fine too. So it was very a relaxed thing. But what really sold it to me was this thing of the opportunity to step into a story for a whole weekend. So to spend a whole weekend in the world of one story and really get to know that world and those characters. And according to what they said to me, you would learn so much from this experience, so much about the art form of storytelling as well as the material that you're working with. You would learn stuff that could feed into your work as a storyteller. And just it just sounded really, really amazing. And I just thought, I really want to take part in this. How can I take part in this? Clearly there's only one way, and that is to actually make it happen in Britain. So I mentioned it to a few people, and lots of people were very, very enthusiastic. So I thought, great. And then, of course, it's always a little bit harder once you actually start pinning people down.
Christine had some slightly traumatic experiences last year where people sort of dropped out, or and because of the way we'd hired venues, it was really imperative that we had a certain number of people there. So I think you have a few battle scars from that, don't you? But I love what you said about the taking the opportunity to spend a weekend with a particular story.
Yeah.
Because when I first heard about this, I had a degree of, not trepidation, but the whole sense that this was going to be 24 different storytellers of radical different backgrounds and experiences. So as Tom said, there was someone who told last year who was telling for the first time. This weekend, I feel we've had even more people telling for it, who are very sort of early in their storytelling work. So 24 radically different tellers, 24 perhaps quite different perspectives and interpretations on the text. How do people feel that works?
Well, it was an incredible immersive experience. You could see people engaging with the story more and more deeply during the course of a weekend. So yes, there were different voices, different approaches to it, but you sparked off each other. I mean, I was telling the section where Odysseus massacres the suitors. And when I'd been working it up, thinking, well, there's this huge long list of names of suitors. Do I really need to mention all of these? And then as the story was going along, I was hearing these names cropping up. I was thinking, yeah, I have to mention that one. And then, when I told those names, everybody was really appreciative because they knew what those suitors had done to really annoy Odysseus. And they felt that they deserved what was coming to them. Or at least they were suddenly echoes of earlier in the story. And I think, that was even more so this weekend with Iliad, because it covers a much shorter space of time. So you've got characters who are in the whole of it, whereas the Odyssey, the geography and the time scale of the story arc is much longer. So I think it built on it. And I think, I think just bringing these different perspectives in, as Christine said, it allows you to immerse yourself in the story in a much deeper, and approach the story in a much deeper way than you would otherwise do if you were sitting at home trying to read it or listening to somebody else's telling, because by the very nature of these stories, most tellings you get recordings of or will see somewhere are abridged, mm-hmm. and have to be done as a commercially viable thing, so they're tailored to the sort of audience who will come to a storytelling performance or a theatre performance. Whereas here, we were much closer to the text, and we had the time to be much closer to the text.
Yes.
We must send an embassy to Achilles. And Agamemnon said yes. And I will give gifts. I will give gifts to persuade Achilles to come back to us. I will give him 7 tripods untarnished by the flame. I will give him 12 talents of gold. And I will give him 10 cauldrons made of ruddy copper.
It's one of the things that Jennifer and Jan said to me as well when we were talking about it initially over in Canada. They said that these epics have the potential to carry tellers who are less experienced, and that actually it didn't matter if you had people who were perhaps less used to it or whatever, as long as they, you know, worked with the text, it would carry them. The story would help them and everybody else. Everybody sort of gets carried along on this wave. I mean, obviously, it would be amazing to see a thing that had like all professional storytellers, or that would be like the dream. But you know, it's also, you know, one or two people who are less experienced. It's really nice, and it's fine if it's, you know, as long as you haven't got too much of a ratio of.
And I don't think it's just a question of experience. When I think about the Odyssey weekend, maybe in the first, I don't know, 8 or so chapters, there were storytellers whose styles maybe aren't my favourite style of storytelling. And yet, by the end, I had a real sense of the story as being something that we were just passing from one person to another, as the story as being something that was separate from the storytellers, as being this kind of much bigger thing that had a momentum to it. And it was probably the most palpable experience I've ever had as a listener of feeling a story that was separate from the tellers, maybe coming through the tellers, maybe the teller was just kind of putting their own spirit, like the story is this great big enormous ball rolling down a mountain and the storytellers choose the course, give it a bit of a shove here and there, but the story has its own weight, its own path that it is going to take.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I find quite often that when a new teller stands up to start their chapter, at first it's like, oh, this is a different style. Oh, and you have to kind of get used to it. But then after a while, that disappears. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, they disappear almost.
Yeah,
behind.
All that's left is the story, and you know, as you say, it's a sort of a relay from storyteller to storyteller. And yeah, as storytellers, we talk about, yeah, it's the storyteller. The story and the storyteller. Yeah. It disappears, and yes, as you described this, that really does seem to happen at these epic weekends.
I will speak bluntly, because I do not want you coming whimpering and fawning at my feet any longer. I scorn Agamemnon's gifts. What use are gifts? Men come to war to meet victory or defeat, and they do not seek for gifts in the doing of it.
And one of the things that I was really interested in, so my wife came to last year's, and beforehand I'd sort of been a little bit cautious, because she's not as immersed in the storytelling world as I am, And, you know, I can go to a storytelling festival and go from one performance to another performance to another performance to another performance because I've got quite a big appetite for this sort of thing. But I thought, wow, how much of an appetite is Erin really going to have? Is she going to enjoy 24 different storytelling performances? And there was something about the fact that we were visiting the same world in each performance and meeting the same characters time and again. She loved it. And I sort of feel like I did not have enough faith in the story going in. And yeah. Christine is nodding her head off because she...
I don't see it as 24 different performances as well. I see it as one performance. It's one group performance, which is a very different thing to a festival. I think at a festival, you know, me at a storytelling festival, I can definitely get, like, storied out. And I get to a point where I don't want to hear any more stories. But this isn't like that because it is one story. It's not lots of different stories and it is a totally different thing.
Yeah, it's one story told by 24 voices. But it is one story. It's one coherent piece.
Having said all the stuff about like different styles and all that, I am also really interested in what would happen if people chose to... If people worked together enough to make it more coherent, and more coherent in style and in choice of words and language.
I think, in future years, we get what story it is and assignments done sooner, there'll be more opportunities for people to meet, like they did during the Odyssey, in the run up to the Odyssey weekend, to work on it together if they've got time.
To be honest, I don't see it ever going. I guess this is more like the model that in Canada, when they've gone into the National Arts Centre and they've done a performance that is ticketed and it's like $100 for the whole day. It's a 12-hour show. It's one day. But it's a, you know, marketed thing to theatre audiences. And they, they're actually just starting working on their Iliad. They're going to do the Iliad in June this year. And they've just had their first rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So it's rehearsed. They all meet up, I think, at least once a month or something. They have directors. They are given text, which they don't have to stick to rigidly, but they stick to it pretty closely, I think. And they're given, guidance of...
Yeah, and that's going to be a very different experience.
Yeah, so I'm sort of very interested in that well, as a different thing.
Yes,
so,
I would love to see that. I'd love to be involved in something like that, or I'd be quite happy to organise something like that, or be involved But
I don't see this epic weekend being that, because it's much more informal and more laid back than that.
But yeah, it's a bit more rough ready and fun, isn't it?
And everybody who comes to this is involved, even the people who... notionally come to just listen. Yeah, at the very minimum, they're chopping vegetables and things, and they're taking part in the discussions of the stories. So they're immersed in the world as well as the tellers are immersed. And between, you know, in the breaks, we've been discussing other aspects of the stories. You know, what happened before, what happens after, what happens to this character in the future, which I suspect you probably wouldn't get, particularly in a 12-hour performance, get that, because there wouldn't be the time for those breaks, and the listeners would not be interacting with the performers so much.
Yeah, no, probably not.
And they watched as Helen approached. Ah, they said, what immortal beauty. No one can blame the men for fighting so long for such a prize. Beauty. Terrible beauty. But still being all that she is, let her go away in the ships and take her scourge from us and from our children.
So if we leave the form as a whole and where we might like to take it in the future just for a moment, we've talked a little bit about the Odyssey last year, which obviously was very big because it was the first time it's kind of happened in this country that I'm aware of. Let's talk specifically about the journey we've just been on, the Iliad. And Christine, you said something earlier. You said something earlier on about how almost as a story, you were enjoying working with the Iliad more. Is that the phrasing you used? What was the phrase you used?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say as a story, because I think it is less of a story than the Odyssey, but just as a thing, really. I I think I like it more than I like the Odyssey. I really, really enjoyed the last week working on my chapter. I just got really into it, much more than I did with the Odyssey. I don't know if that was partly because I had a different head on for organising the Odyssey.
The Iliad surprised me. Again, maybe I didn't have enough faith in it, but I thought, this is the Iliad. It's basically just a battle. It's a lot of back and forth. And it wasn't until sort of going into the text in some detail, it wasn't until getting here, yes, it is just a battle, and yes, there's a lot of back and forth and almost repetition, but when you get those really human moments, those little family interactions, they are so poignant. Mm. I really feel like a convert to the Iliad.
Yeah.
I expect this is going to be a feature of me in these epic weekends. Each year I'm going to come along with slight reservations and I'm just going to be like, whoa, all right, yeah. I was a fool.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the things that really helped me was I did a bit of reading around and I found some poetry that was written by contemporary poets, but very much inspired by and writing from and or rewriting the Iliad, and somehow that having this modern perspective and just opened up this world for me somehow that I then had this much easier way in, and I went back, and also the translation.
Can you talk a little bit about specific texts?
Yeah, so there's two. So the first one was this, it's called War Music by Logue, and this poet set out to do a complete rewriting book by book of the Iliad. He didn't complete it. He spent about 20 years on it and unfortunately got dementia, so he wasn't able to finish it. But he did do quite a lot of books. He did about 12 books or something of the 24. And each book almost stands on its own as a poem. And they're really amazing. They're it's very, very macho and testosterone-fueled, as the Iliad is, but it somehow makes it more immediate, and because it's in such modern, presented in such a modern way, it's almost like Mad Max or something. It's this kind of almost apocalyptic, the chariots are called cars, and they're like, it's very visceral, and very, very strong images in that interpretation of it. And so I was just given this incredible visual picture of some of these battle scenes. So that was the first thing. And then the second one was the
Alice Oswald's memorial.
Yeah. So what she... It's incredible actually reading these two together because they're almost like opposites. What the Logue is, it's the story, and it's a very masculine take on it. And Alice Oswald's thing is that she strips away the story and she presents what is left. And what is left is a list of people who've died and all the bits of information you have about those people, which sometimes is nothing, or sometimes it's a few lines, or sometimes a few verses.
So it's an odd feature of the Iliad, isn't it? That you'll have a character that you know quite a bit about, and then they'll throw a spear, and almost while the spear is in midair, you'll get this, oh yes, that spear was destined to hit such and such was the son of such and such, and they'd grown up, they'd played with the horses in the fields. So you really get these little
snapshots.
Insights, yeah, these little visionaries, these snapshots of the people involved in this conflict. And the Alice Oswald text is absolutely
and
gorgeous.
To me, the Alice, that is like the female perspective on the Iliad. So they're like two sides, these two, for me, those two texts. And she also has got the similes, so there's all these similes in the Iliad, and she hasn't used all of them by any means, but she's kept a few of them, and it's incredibly beautiful. There's no story to it, but it's just pure distilled beauty.
The watchfires of the Trojans were scattered over the plain, as numerous as the stars in the sky. And just as a waterfall falls down a rock face, leaving black streaks on the rock, so Agamemnon wept.
When the south wind showers mist on the mountaintop, a blowing bane to shepherds, better than night to thieves. When a man can see no farther than he can heave a stone. So the dust came clouding, rising from the feet of armies trampling at top speed across the plain.
When a farmer burns his fields at the end of the harvest, sending spark and flame dancing through the tinder-dry stubble, and all the creatures that have made their home among the crops go stumbling blind and choking into the ditch at the edge of his land. It was like that. When Achilles went raging across the plain of Troy.
And she's called it Memorial because she thinks that the Iliad comes from this tradition of this lament poetry, remembering the dead, and that it's all about that.
Yeah, it reminds me in some ways of Cad Gothae.
I think that's probably another discussion.
yeah, let's keep it. I think you're right. And certainly I had chapter 24, I had the closing chapter, and the only way I felt that I could make sense of it in the end was to bring it almost to the fact that this is a lament. This is a glorious lament in some ways because they're very heroic people, but it's a war story, and part of a war story is that you have to go back home to all the people and say, well, we're not all here. Some people fell in foreign lands. Okay, I think we should try and bring this to a close because we're hogging the nicest seats in the youth hostel. I want to close though by talking about some of our highlights from the weekend, and they can either be things that have happened in the stories that have really impressed us or things that have happened in the weekend as a whole. Any highlights for you, Tom?
Oh, I think your closing was really, a major highlight. I think you brought it to close perfectly with that list of the dead. And then a single line from each chapter of a book. I think it really rounded it up.
Thank you. That was something Amanda Smith came up with last year for closing the Odyssey. Was let's get some music playing, and let's have each of the tellers just give one line from their story. And it's nice to have a closing ritual because this is such a kind of emotional journey and you're so in the world for a whole weekend that I feel like it's very good to have invoke the muses in the beginning, and in the end we have to kind of we have to close the story, we have to honour the tellers, and we have to step back into the rest of the world.
And I'd completely forgotten about that in organising it, but we needed to at least tail it with a ceremony, perhaps even top it next year. So it's something to, a tradition to carry on, I think.
The Greeks were true to Achilles' promise. 9 days later, the wood came back on those carts, and they spent a whole day building that great funeral pyre over Hector's body, and it burned. The fires raged through every hour of the night. And in the morning, the coals were so hot, they brought out whole barrels of wine and they tipped them onto those blazing coals to cool them, and the wine hissed and the air turned purple. And then Hector's 9 brothers stepped into the ash, raked it back, found his bones, wrapped them in a purple cloth and placed them in a golden coffin. Just outside the city of Troy, there was a little mound with a cleft, a cave in it. It was into that they placed the golden coffin, and they lay white stones on top of it, and they covered those all over with earth. And they went back inside to feast, to drink, and to weep. These were the funeral rites given to Hector, son of Priam, tamer of horses.
Well, I'm very unfortunately, I missed the first night because I was unwell. So I feel like I didn't get the invoking of the muses, but I suppose highlights for me, I just love the scene where Hector is with his wife and his child.
Yes, it's so powerful
and beautiful.
Where he says goodbye at the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, Tara Hartley had that chapter. Yeah. She did an incredible job with that.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know how much research you guys have done for this year. I didn't feel like I'd done, like I'd had a proper chance to really read the whole text. I knew my chapters, but I didn't know the rest very well. And what with going near the end, when other people do their chapters earlier on, just the sense of how much it nourishes your telling. Tara did hers, and I felt like I knew that family. So when I got to do Hector's body being taken back to that family, yeah, I could understand how upset they were, because I'd seen them say goodbye and the hope and the fear that was with them during that goodbye scene.
Yeah.
Hector turned and left Priam's palace and made his way back through the well-built streets. And as he approached the Scaean gates, Andromache came running up to him. "Oh, Hector," she said, "you have returned. Do not go back out to the battle. For if I were to lose you, I would have lost everything and could no longer go on living. My father has died. My mother has died. All 7 of my brothers were brought down by Achilles in a single day. You are all that is left to me. You are father and mother and brothers, as well as my own dear husband. Do not turn and leave me and your son alone."
And well, the other highlight, I don't know, there were actually lots of highlights, but another highlight for me was actually just that I got to do the death of Patroclus. I just loved working on that and thinking about that in this kind of week leading up to it, and I just feel like that was a real gift to me to have that bit, because I just was assigned a chapter at random, but it felt like a real central moment, like a hub where things shift in the story. And it was at the end of the Saturday, so it was the end of a long day of telling. And so, yeah, it's a funny thing when you have a heavy moment like that and then that's it for the day. But really wonderful as well to sit with that heaviness.
And I think there's a real art, because so many people die during the Iliad, there's a real art to going, all right, this person, we really feel it. We really care. This is going to be a poignant moment when this character dies. And it was done very well. I think it was a great closing to our
I
first
really think
there.
It is all there though in the text, you know, that's just how it is. I think that's not
But one of the things I found, yes, you're right, that was a great closing of the first day, and I'm really glad the timing worked out that way. So I wasn't even thinking about the content of the chapters when I was I was just following the same timetable, which book is when that we used last year.
I want to mention the food has been ridiculously over the top nice this weekend.
I think Jenny Bailey is my hero for this weekend because she's really been not feeling well, and she's still managed to pretty much single-handedly, with people chipping in, but she's definitely in control of all the food, and it's amazing.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah, this weekend would not have been the same without her.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good, really good. And I suppose in terms of the text and highlights from the text, I'm now blindsided because these people have already mentioned my favourite moments from the text.
I have another kind of favourite thing as well, though, and that is just today on the last day, just not any one bit, but just the sense of this kind of building up towards the end and the building up of this kind of like emotional tension almost. Really, because at the beginning, I mean, I missed the beginning, but the start of Saturday, it's like battle, 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 but you can't kind of, it's just, it almost washes over you. It's almost light-hearted.
Zeus said, "Of all the cities, Troy is my favourite. But here's the deal. If in the future
I have a mind to destroy three other cities, even if it's your three favourite cities, if I now allow you to have Troy destroyed, will you let me destroy those others? Hera looked at him, ox-eyed. She said, well, even if it's my three favourite cities, even if it's Argos, Sparta, or Mycenae, I'll let you. Let's give way to each other. And so, it was agreed.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. You've got all this battle, battle, battle. But there were some moments of almost hilarity, you know, great humour coming out, even from the original text, and then then really brought out by the tellers. And
I think putting it back into the oral performance helps the humour come through. Definitely. It's very easy when you read it to kind of, especially because Homer uses quite a lot of irony, and if you just read something quickly, you can miss the fact there's irony there. But when someone says it out loud, it was lovely. Yeah. And Tom had a great moment where Hera goes to her husband Zeus and she's wearing the girdle of desire. And Zeus is really, he sees her and he's on fire for her. And he goes, oh, Hera, I yearn for you even more. And then Tom just does this list of all the other women that Zeus has had affairs with, which is from the text.
Yes, it's all there.
But if you were reading that, you might miss quite how funny it is. Where actually, the way Tom did it is brilliant. And you can see Hera there, because she's gone there to seduce him, gritting her teeth and trying to remain looking alluring as he mentions all the other women that he has been to bed with. I'm going to say it's my highlight. The way that some of the kind of secondary characters have come out. And I'm thinking particularly of Nesta. Nesta, who's developed, and I'm sure it's there in the text, but has developed really into this character who is a little bit long-winded and who maybe is a bit verbose, you know, and he's too old to fight, but he's still on the front lines in a chariot just to give good advice to all of his men. And his advice is sound, he's very clever, but he does go on at length, and that's come out, that's been funny.
But then suddenly, so you think of him as old, sort of almost stick in the mud, this is the way we used to do things. And then in the funeral games for Patroclus, he tells his son how to cheat.
Yes, he does. He does really know everything, and he will explain it. The other person we've had a lot of fun this weekend is the kind of Ajax, the Telamon Ajax fan club, and the lesser fan club of Ajax the Lesser, and the glory of that. Guys, it's been brilliant speaking to you. I want to wrap this up. So, will there be another one next year?
Yes.
Do we know what we're telling yet?
No.
No, but there will be another epic weekend, and long, long may they continue.
So that was the Iliad weekend. And I'm really grateful to Christine and to Tom for spending a bit of time with me afterwards to talk about their perspectives on the story and their feelings about the whole weekend. I can't sing the praises of the epic weekend enough as a thing. It feels like such a rich, nourishing way to experience this sort of material. If you're into mythology, if you're into storytelling, I'd really recommend getting involved. Ironically, since I recorded that interview and those last two questions, what are we going to tell next? Everything's changed. Like, at the moment, I'm not sure there is going to be an epic weekend in 2015. It may be that we take a year out just kind of chill and to organise a bit of a team to put them together in the future. But we know what we're going to be telling next. We're going to be telling the Norse myths. We're going to do everything from creation through to Ragnarok. And that is going to be an incredible weekend. I'm trying to resist just saying that's going to be epic because it feels too obvious. But the Norse myths is going to be wonderful. So if you're interested, you can keep up with what's going on by going to Facebook, if you're on Facebook, and looking for the Epic Weekenders group, and joining that. Or if you're not on Facebook, feel free to drop me an email at tim.ralphs@gmail.com, T-I-M-R-A-L-P-H-S, podcast@gmail.com, and then I'll make sure that you're added to whatever mailing list is going on and that you're kept in the loop about future weekends. Big thanks again to Tom Goodale and to Christine Cooper. I also want to thank all the other voices who you've heard little extracts from their telling throughout the course of the recording. I'll put their names in the show notes. I'm going to play you out now with a bit of Steffi Harrop telling from Hector and Achilles meeting on the battlefield just outside Troy.
And then finally, when Achilles was only the length of a spear heft away, something gave way inside Hector. Something broke or snapped or something deserted him. And he felt his body flood with terror, and he turned on his heel and he ran. He ran not towards the city, but around the walls, towards the fig tree on the corner, where the two streams of Scamander bubble up out of the earth, one warm and one cold. It's a place where the girls and the women of the city go out to wash their clothes. They gather there and they sing songs and they speak to one another and they tell dirty jokes. They did, anyway, before the war came. And passing those two springs, Hector looked back over his shoulder and saw Achilles coming after him with all the speed of his swift feet. And Hector fled then, fast as the hawk of the mountains, the ravening hawk when she chases down a tender dove. He flew around those walls. But Achilles of the swift feet kept after him on and on. Like two men in a dream, they chased each other round those walls once, twice, three times. And the world held its breath. And high on Olympus, Zeus himself looked down. He saw brave Hector fleeing. And he said, if a god can love a man, I have loved this man. And Zeus, the father of the gods, sighed. And on the wind of that breath, grey-eyed Athene went darting down to the plain, and as he came for the third time past the gates, Hector saw his brother, Deiphobus, standing there, looking suspiciously grey-eyed. And Deiphobus spoke, Hector, brother, why flee from this man? Stand beside me, we'll stand together, and we will see Achilles' day of death. And so Hector stopped. Hector stood in front of the gates of the city, and he made ready to fight with great Achilles. It was Achilles who hurled the first spear, hefting it in its hand to test its weight, and then hurling it towards Hector, who ducked and watched it skim over his shoulder, go clattering harmlessly in the distance. Then Hector lifted his own spear and hurled it towards Achilles, and it landed with a crash and a clatter in the middle of his shield, a clatter that seemed to shake the whole field. Then Hector held out his hand. He said, brother, give me another spear. Deiphobus, quickly, another spear. I can do it. I am sure the gods are with me. Deiphobus? Brother, I need it. And then he saw, beside Achilles, the shape of grey-eyed Athena, handing him another spear.
The Room Behind the Bookcase is created by Tim Ralphs. For music details, links, and a list of upcoming gigs, go to timralphs.com.
And I am distraught to announce that at no point in either of these books does Telamon Ajax appear.
Aww. That's good. He probably have died if he hadn't.
It's true. He is far away. He is safe. All is really well.
Probably lifting a boulder and throwing it.
He is. He's almost certainly doing that while having a drink, a cup of tea with the other hand. You know, all is well with him. He's happy. I just sort of need you to know that as we go forward.